following is based on true events.
Good evening and hello. Before we jump right in, if you haven't listened to part one in this series, please take a listen to that episode first, before you listen to tonight's, just to ensure that you understand this installment in its entirety. Then, when you're done, pop right back and we'll be right here waiting for you. Thank you. As a reminder, and perhaps surprisingly, I entered this investigation with a firm belief that ghosts were purely a psychological phenomenon. There is more than enough evidence to support all the claims from the world over that there does in fact exist a phenomena purported to be what is commonly referred to as ghosts or hauntings. But my background in psychology and experience of living with a professional paranormal investigator only convinced me over the years that psychology and psychological incident and circumstance would provide the eventual outcome and answers for these occurrences. Additionally, I've been somewhat torn over the last month or so, torn and in two minds as to whether I should even release this episode at all. You see, for me, the investigation that we conducted has forever imprinted a darkness on my psyche that I haven't been able to really shake since we conducted the investigation almost a year ago. What scared and chilled me at the time has left me thinking over and over and questioning what I saw, what I heard, and what I experienced. It expanded my questioning and thoughts on this subject and answered nothing. It made me question everything that we as a team did and questioned my own experience. It also placed a thought smack bang in the center of my mind, and that was, who the hell is honestly going to believe me when I tell them? And I think that is what has made me go back and forth with this issue so much over the last month or so. But this last weekend, on February 7th, 2021, I spoke with an old friend of mine. It was his advice that finally swayed my decision to drop this second part tonight. Upon voicing my indecision to him, he quoted the famous words of Carl Sagan, the American astronomer and astrophysicist, who said, "Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence." Jamie, you already disproved and called rubbish on the accepted science of ghost hunters and professional ghost investigators in the first episode, he said. So you aren't going to get that extraordinary evidence needed to back up your extraordinary claim. You establish that there isn't any proven scientific technique that can be used to fundamentally evidence the existence of ghosts right now, as if there was, they would have been proven by now, especially given the number of people who claim to experience the phenomenon. So with part two and the events you describe therein, you aren't making a claim for scientific proof, you are simply telling your truth. And that's all anyone can do in this field, at least until science catches up with that of the visionary Dr. Egon Spengler, of course. My friend was right, and with that, I give you part two, dedicated to my good friend Brody. This is Ghosts, a Dead Soul Social Club Investigation, part two. As you will recall, in episode one of this series, we introduced you to Martin and revealed to you part of his story. We also explored some of the methods used in the investigation of the ghost phenomenon. Whilst my perception of ghost hunters has always been that their science is littered with fallacies, I was sold enough on Martin and his story to want to look into it further. So, almost a year ago, my team and I took a step with both feet into the realm of the metaphysical. Martin looked Grace and I dead in the eye, and with a single tear running down his cheek, he said softly, "I'm both terrified and desperate to know in equal measure. Are you also worried that you'll find out something that you don't want to know about your grandparents?" Grace whispered in reply. "Maybe somewhat. I don't want to change how I think about them." Martin, Grace and I were stood in Martin's childhood playroom. It was 2:20 a.m. The rest of the team were all in the house's detached garage next door, monitoring us in a CIA level of surveillance equipment that kept close eye and recorded temperature movement, sound, radiation, night vision, clear vision, and human inaudible sound waves. So many investigations that we had read about, viewed, and researched attempted all of these things, but seemed to do so while walking around the locations that they investigate. This is particularly perplexing to me because, as is the case with research and monitoring of animals in the wild and various natural habitats, any intrusion into said habitat will undoubtedly affect the surroundings and influence any data that's captured, This is practically science 101. An example, if a room is 18 degrees Celsius in temperature, and three humans, all with an average body temperature of 37 degrees Celsius, enter said room, particularly if they're behaving in an animated way, shall we say, such as sometimes the behavior on various ghost hunts and so on, it won't take very long for the temperature in the room to change and the equipment to pick up and record the temperature spike. So given that, this was a primary and main reason why we felt that setting a monitoring station in a location away from the main house was so important. Each room was filled with our technology, gadgets and so on, where everything could be monitored from the garage, which was separate from the main house and without any human involvement and influence. The array of data gathering gadgets, if anything, made me feel self-aware. Standing in that room with Grace, with Martin, and knowing that the level of technology that was monitoring us and our surroundings gave you various eerie thoughts. We were stood in the playroom to complete one simple task, something so inane and meaningless that you wouldn't give it a second thought on most days. Yet, Martin was visibly trembling with fear and quite obviously very emotional. We had tasked Martin with placing a sweater that he had worn as a child in the closet of his playroom. That was it. To just open the closet and set the folded garment down on the floor in there and close the door again. That's all he had to do. We had promised him, Grace and I, that we would come with him, and we had promised him that as soon as it was done, he could return to the garage with the others. It's worth mentioning that the garage is a location that Martin had told us that nothing eerie or creepy, as he put it, had ever happened whilst he lived at that house, and that he never felt any unease in there. As a child, when he would feel spooked or anxious, he would head into the garage to, and I quote, reset his fears. The garage was a separate building from the main house, about 30 feet or 10 meters, give or take an inch, away from the main house or building, if you will. When both teams had arrived at the house on day one of the investigation, knowing this meant we all thought the garage would be the ideal location for our base location. As previously mentioned, it gave us the opportunity to not interfere with any data or any of the readings from the main house. If you're confused right now, allow us to go back just a little. As we mentioned in the previous episode, between September and December 2019, my team and I conducted in-depth interviews with Martin following the message that he had initially sent us. On our third session of interviews, we asked Martin to expand on his experiences, to tell us everything that he can recall and include every single detail that he could think of. The following is an excerpt from the transcript of that interview and are entirely Martin's own words, verbatim, if you will. Well, I think I was around 11 or so. I remember it was coming up to Christmas as we all had our decorations up in the house and my grandmother had taken me to see Home Alone 2 in the cinema the week before. At the time, I was a huge science fiction nerd. I still am, to tell you the truth. But at that point in my life, I was particularly obsessed with the Back to the Future movies. I must have seen them all around 50 times each when I was a kid. That year at school, parents' evening, my teacher told my grandparents that I had aspirations of becoming a scientist after I'd left school and university. I think that impressed my grandparents, who were always keen to encourage the endeavour by buying books and toys and videos and all sorts that they could develop and encourage my scientific aspirations. They were absolutely amazing. Of course, in my mind, a scientist was cool and all, but what I really wanted to become was an inventor. So science, yes, but with a level of uncertainty that I don't think my grandparents envisioned. I also wanted to build things and create things, and yes, before you say it, I wanted to follow exactly in the footsteps of Doc Brown from the Back to the Future movies with his time-traveling DeLorean. What an awesome adventure that would be. I even saw a documentary when I was younger. It featured Stephen Hawking, and he said that time travel was theoretically possible. So I daydreamed of the reality endlessly as a kid. I thought it was absolutely fascinating. So the reason I'm beating on about Back to the Future so much is because at that time my science skills were being used to develop my own time machine. Not a real one, obviously. I'm not some wonder kid. I was working on my own play version that I built in the empty closet in my playroom, something that I could sit in and let my imagination run wild. All that was in there was a clothes rail and quite literally nothing else. No clothes on the rail, just a bare closet. So I put an old desk chair in there, one that I had taken the metal swiveling base off, and I kitted the walls of the closet out with buttons, switches, battery-powered lights, an old Atari keyboard, Nintendo joystick, and my grandfather's old and broken, which meant I could use it, 4-track PA mixing desk, which had some sweet knobs and switches on. It looked futuristic and complex, whilst in all actuality, it was just bits of old electronics fastened to a wall with batteries enabling them to light up and move around. The week that I finished it, I spent hours in there. Then day and night in the weeks following, I became obsessed with playing in my own time machine, pretending I was traveling through time and flying through wormholes in deep space. It was great fun, and both of my grandparents were super impressed at how well I'd put it together and managed to get all the little lights working and powered up. Even it did cost me a fortune from my pocket money to buy all the batteries that it needed. "It's like your own little spaceship, boy," my grandfather told me. "Just make sure you're back from your space adventure in time for dinner," he also quipped. My grandfather was such a joker. On the day before Christmas Eve that year, I was playing in my time machine pretty late, maybe 9 or 10 p.m. Really late for an 11-year-old anyway. I had been sat in there for about an hour, I think. I had a New York Yankees baseball hat on backwards and my grey sweater with a large rainbow logo across the front of it. After a while, I had burned myself out playing and I was just kind of sat there in the dark in silence, occasionally pressing the odd button or flicking the odd switch off and on. It glowed red, yellow and blue. There were lights flickering occasionally. Boredom was setting in at this point. I was almost ready for bed. At that point, I felt a little pinch on my back, just below my neckline. I figured there was something sharp sticking out of the chair or something, so I just rearranged my back a little and shrugged it off. Then it happened again, but this time it was near the back of my armpit. It felt like my sweater was being pulled at. It must have been caught on something and was really annoying. I turned around and felt across the leather chair, feeling for something that was sticking out or stuck to the chair. There was nothing, nothing hooking or prodding into me. I also felt across my back to see if anything was stuck on me. There was nothing on me either. I turned back around and almost instantly I felt another pinch in the center of my back. This pinch was more pronounced though, and it pulled at my sweater more, pulling me back ever so slightly. There was certainly movement, which startled me a little. I started to get freaked out now, as I was feeling more like a person was physically pinching and pulling at me, rather than something sharp digging into me, which I first thought. I pushed the door to get the hell out of there, but it was tightly closed, and it wouldn't move. There was no lock on the closet door, just a little catch for it to pop closed. A kitten could push it open, but for whatever reason, it was jarred firmly closed, and I could not move it. As I pushed, with all the force I could muster, more pinches and pulls at my back and neck came, three in quick succession, really yanking at me. I can safely say I was really panicking and crying a little at this point. I pulled my hat off and tossed it to my feet, and then pulled my sweater off and threw it behind me, behind the chair, too afraid to look in that direction to see what was there, pulling. I banged the door with my shoulder and it flung open, crashing into the bedroom wall, and I fell out of the closet into the floor. Still panicked and still crying, I sprung up to my feet and ran down the hall towards the stairs. My grandmother was out that night, but when I burst into the living room, my grandfather was asleep in his chair, completely oblivious to my horror. I felt like I had run from thunder in fear and something was behind me, but as I stood in the doorway and looked at my grandfather peacefully sleeping, the house fell silent and at ease again. I tried to avoid going into my playroom for a few days. It was Christmas, so I had new toys and gifts to keep me occupied downstairs, and it took my mind off what had happened. But a few days after Christmas, my grandmother asked me to take my new toys and presents from downstairs up to my playroom. Reluctantly, I did so. The door of the closet was still wide open, as I'd left it on Christmas Eve night. Nothing had been touched or moved since. I don't think anyone had been in there since. I popped my new things away, and I looked into the closet to grab my rainbow sweater, but it wasn't there. My Yankees hat was, but not the sweater. I wanted to wear it out, so I asked both of my grandparents if they had seen it, or popped it in the wash. My grandfather Stacy hadn't been in my playroom in weeks, let alone see my sweater. My grandmother pretty much said the same. This worried me, but I didn't let on. I didn't want my grandparents to see that something was up. I did this a lot back then. It worried me though, because where the hell was it? Where had the sweater gone? Gradually, that incident fell to the back of my mind, and I would forget all about the sweater. Other strange and scary happenings would overwrite that one as the most recent one to be stone cold petrified of after all, and bizarre and creepy instances would happen on an almost monthly basis, if I'm honest. Now, you remember that I told you that I moved to my aunt's house at age 16 when both my grandparents had died. Well, on the day that we cleared out my grandparents' house and emptied it of all furniture and belongings, either moving them to be disposed of or family members selecting what items they would like to keep, well, I wanted to take one last look at the place once the house was completely empty. I was devastated that I lost both my grandparents, and I stood in an empty bedroom for around an hour just remembering them and missing them and staring into the near distance. Finally, the clearance was completed and my aunt called me from down the stairs. "Martin, love, are you ready? We're leaving now," she called. "I'm coming," I replied, and I did a quick scan of the room to ensure nothing was left behind. I did the same in my old bedroom, the guest room, the bathroom, and my old playroom. The place was completely clear. Finally, I had one last quick peek in the closet, inside my old time machine, and I froze in shock and fear. Hanging on the clothes rail, the only item in the entire closet, something that I hadn't seen for over 5 years, was my rainbow sweater. I grabbed it and pulled it off the hanger. It actually confused me and I wrecked my brain trying to make sense of how it was there. How could it be there? Where it had been for so long, and how it ended up hanging in the closet once again. Where had it been? I've kept the sweater to this day. Back when I was 16, I thought and dwelled on that a lot. And even to this day, I occasionally think about the sweater and what had happened to it. Although less than I used to think about it, to be honest. But I still keep the sweater in a drawer in my bedroom to this very day. Okay. So like in the last episode, take a minute to digest Martin's words here. At face value, they seem both fantastic and potentially difficult to believe, and a little bit troubling. From my perspective, I watched Martin pass 3 polygraph tests that specifically asked him about this incident and his rainbow sweater. I also witnessed Martin getting incredibly emotional on a number of occasions when my team and I pushed him in regards to this and other childhood incidents. It quickly became clear that a lot of Martin's memories and fears were anchored to his relationship with his grandparents. So his love for them also triggered his fear and anxieties. So whilst my team would conduct research in regards to the property and the area where Martin grew up, I also personally conducted some research into Martin's family history and origins, as I thought the links may be interesting and very relevant. Martin was completely in the dark in regards to the origins of his family, with the exception of one glaringly obvious fact. His grandmother spoke with a German accent, so Martin knew that she originally came from Germany, and more specifically, he was aware that she came from Frankfurt. Martin's grandfather was originally from London. Prior to the Second World War, Martin's grandfather lived and worked as an engineer for a period in Eggelsbach. He even contributed to the construction of the Eichelsbach Bridge in the 1920s while employed with Hochtief Achtien Gesellschaft, which is now a multinational and well-respected corporation, I'm told. Apologies, by the way, for my German pronunciations. As you can probably tell, I don't speak a word of German. You don't have to be a genius to work out that while in Frankfurt, Martin's grandparents met and got married. They would eventually move to the UK in the mid-30s during the rise of Nazism and the Third Reich. But prior to that, they spent 4 years living in Frankfurt as a newly married couple. Martin's grandfather became acquainted with his grandmother's social circle pretty quickly, and also became involved in a group that Martin's grandmother was a member of. They were called, and please again pardon my pronunciation as my German is not very good, but they were called Arbeitsgruppe zur Kommunikation nach dem Tod Or, roughly translated, the Study Group on Afterlife Communication. The group conducted seances and various rituals in order to communicate with deceased spirits. These groups and seances were hugely popular at the time in the Western world, and particularly in Germany. Martin's grandmother was actually a spiritualist medium, although I understand that that may not be how she described herself. Martin, surprisingly, was completely unaware of this element to his grandmother's past, but was visibly relieved at the same time to learn that his grandparents weren't involved in anything nefarious, in his view. Anyway, after being married for a few years, you can imagine that Martin's grandfather also became accustomed to and involved with a spiritualist group. And although detached from the rest of the German group, when they relocated to the UK, the two continued their practices in their new home and country. In 1947, they set up a UK-based group in Oxfordshire named Enlightenment and Answers, and gained a small but loyal group of members. Martin told us that his grandparents would occasionally have a group of their friends over. But this was always late at night when he was in bed, and he never really gave any thought to what this group was, other than just friends socialising. They also went to other members' houses, and Martin recalls his grandparents would always leave the telephone number of the house they were at. Martin recalls further, they were always uncle this or auntie that. They weren't blood relations, just close friends of my grandparents. One Christmas, Aunt Gloria, who was one of the ladies involved with the group, I guess, gave me an antique hourglass as a gift, which I thought was a little odd or eccentric. Another lady, Aunt Irene, gave me a necklace with a weird hand symbol hanging from it, sort of like a hand laid flat with an eye in the palm, for my 13th birthday. During my research, I discovered that Martin's grandmother had a sister who was 4 years her senior. She committed suicide, unfortunately, in 1941, and this was followed shortly after by her mother, Martin's great-grandmother, who died in 1943, just 2 years later, from pneumonia. I asked Martin, was he aware of either of these deaths, and he stated that he wasn't. He didn't know that his grandmother had a sister, let alone that she had committed suicide. I spoke with Martin and I said that I would imagine the loss of a sister and a mother so close together must have been difficult for your grandmother. If it was, Martin said, then she must have blocked the emotions or buried them deep down, as she never spoke about either of them. This was Martin's opinion until I told him that his grandmother's sister was named Angela. My grandmother spoke to Angela all the time. My grandparents discussed Angela regularly. I remember that, Martin said, slightly surprised. In what context? I asked. Well, they regularly discussed things that Angela said at their social nights. They discussed whether she would attend and occasionally argued about what they thought she meant when they spoke with her. Maybe argue is the wrong word. Disagreed, maybe, Martin clarified. Was Angela the name of one of your grandparents' friends that came over as well? I said. No, definitely not. I knew them all by name, Martin came back. Like I said, Aunt this or Uncle that. There was definitely no Angela in the group. At face value, this certainly seemed intriguing. Were my grandparents trying to contact my great-aunt and great-grandmother with a spiritualist group, do you think? Martin asked. I had no idea, and I told him so. I was wary that without having all the information and facts, that I didn't want to rush to judgment in this situation, and I especially didn't want to guess at something that seemed quite fantastic and influenced Martin's opinion and thoughts. Do you think Angela was a presence in this house? Martin asked me. Truth be told, I wasn't sure what I believed at that point. If, and this was a big if for me, but if ghosts were apparitions of deceased souls, then it's certainly possible that Martin's grandparents may have been trying to contact them spiritually. I must add that all this is pure speculation and at the far end of possible answers as to what was going on at his grandparents' group meetings and why they referred to an absent Angela. I felt uncomfortable suggesting this with any likelihood to Martin, though. So instead I told him, look, mate, the other team have a medium due to attend tonight, and she will be here in a short while. Why don't you tell her your thoughts and theories and see what she makes of it? Although I would suggest waiting until she offers you information first, as I think she's better placed to talk about things like this than I. Emma Patchford was a spiritualist medium that worked alongside the London team that had accompanied us for the investigation. She was based in Hatfield, just north of London, so she travelled to the house separately and was due to arrive at around 8 p.m. on the second night. So we are going back a little bit here, prior to us placing the rainbow sweater in the playroom closet. Just bear that in mind. The temperature that night was 3 degrees Celsius outside. So as I previously mentioned, we've dived in fairly quickly. So now we are going to take it slow and steady and take a step back a moment just to catch up on things. On the first day that we arrived, both teams set up the equipment that we had brought and discussed a joint and agreed approach to the investigation. Ultimately, due to various personal reasons, only two members of the London team could be there for the investigation, namely Tom and Ben. Tom was a high school science teacher who specialised in physics, and Ben was an electrician. The ghost investigating that they did in their spare time. Over the course of the first day, both teams got to know each other while prepping the house with our gear and spent some time over lunch sharing experience, stories and our backgrounds, etc. Both Tom and Ben came across to all my team as very honest, intelligent and with integrity, which was pleasantly welcome. Regardless, however, we had to ensure that data was not compromised, so my team remained vigilant in our monitoring. The monitoring of data, events and those involved, I will add. I will say this now. On the first day and night, I am more than confident to say that zero phenomenon was observed. Nothing was recorded or sensed, and that is true for all involved and the equipment. I do, however, have to add, at the insistence of Tom from the London team, that Norman the Beagle, who came along for the investigation, did have a barking fit when he entered the house at first. This lasted well over an hour, and the dog was visibly agitated for an animal that rarely barks or even moves all that much normally. We set up a cosy little sleeping area for Norman in the garage with us, so he always had company, and he almost immediately settled down once in there. Now, and this is a hell of a big now, I am more than aware of the folklore, legend, old wives' tale, or however you want to describe it in regards to dogs being able to see or sense things that humans can't. This is absolutely the reason why Tom wanted this included in this episode, as he felt that Norman definitely picked up on something. But I am not going to make any claims regarding this or go into any further detail as to give this any basis of reality, purely as there is no scientific basis for dogs being able to see or sense ghosts or any other such phenomenon. But I will add that I will leave this up to your best judgment and interpretation and allow you the respect to arrive at your own conclusions regarding this part of the story. Anyway, during the first day and night, the temperature in the house remained consistent with the exterior temperature, minus wind chill fluctuations as would be expected. No motion detectors were triggered. We used a dual technology approach to our sensors, which included PIR, or passive infrared, and also a microwave emitter to cover all bases. Also, no sound above ambience was recorded or registered. Light levels were consistent with natural light levels in locations where the exterior light could protrude, and rooms with no access to natural light sources remained as black as pitch with zero fluctuations, not even under door changes. Levels of carbon monoxide through the entire house was neutral at 4 ppm, or parts per million, which is exactly what it should be for a property that's uninhabited and with a gas supply completely shut down. As the only power supply in the house was our own, off-site supply, EMF meters registered minimal readings with no fluctuations and well below the NIRP, or the International Commission on Non-Ionizing Radiation Protection, advised levels, which is great because if levels were higher, as well as being anomalous, it would also have been dangerous to us within the house, and obviously Norman the dog. Prior to installing our equipment, we took a reading of 0.4 milligauss from a gauss meter, which climbed to 0.7 milligauss when all our equipment was running. These were expected readings of natural or static energy in the home. The average background levels of magnetic fields was 0.04 microtesla, which was perfectly in line with average UK readings. And additionally, this was expected given that there were no power lines, electrified trainways, or substations in the vicinity of the house to affect any readings. Radon was measured at 0.4 pCIL, or picocuries per litre of air, which is where it should be. We also took a 34% humidity reading and 190 ppb, or parts per billion, reading for airborne chemicals, or VOCs. CO2 was read at 332 ppm, again, parts per million, and again, the house is uninhabited in a small rural town, so these readings are what we would have expected. While all these readings and data may seem like boring window display, it's all very relevant, as all of these readings, if out of the ordinary, could answer the phenomenon reported in this house before we even begin the investigation. Finally, I'll mention that our trusty Geiger counter gave us a reading of 0.05 to 0.10 USV/HR or microsieverts, which was a nice safe level of radiation. All in all, if any of these readings changed dramatically during the investigation, it would have meant a significant exposure to human life of an influencer. Now, said influencer could be the reason for perceiving a haunting. Changes of this data, to clarify, would not confirm or signify a ghost or haunting. I genuinely think some paranormal researchers forget this, or certainly at least misinterpreted what their data is actually telling them. But maybe that's just me being a judgmental Judy, so there is no offence intended to anyone out there that's listening that might be one of said investigators. On the second day of the investigation, I chose to add luminescent pigment powder across the doorways in the house so that I could track any movement in or out of the rooms. As well as showing an imprint where someone may have stood, I could use UV light to see where said person continued to walk for some time afterwards. I was excited for the arrival of Emma Patchford that evening to see what she could bring to the investigation and additionally observe her interaction with Martin. At around 5:30 p.m. in the afternoon, Tom, Ben and Mark from my team headed to the nearest store to pick up food and supplies. Myself and Grace stayed at the garage. At 5:43 p.m, a lighting rig that we had erected at the top of the stairs in the house fell, which triggered some of our monitoring equipment. Grace and I reviewed the footage and data and found no anomalies, so it was just likely an improperly secured fixture. I headed into the house to refasten the lighting rig, while Grace remained in the garage with Norm and the dog and paused the equipment to avoid me being in the house affecting the data and triggering further recordings. It took me a while to get the lighting rig sorted and to refit, but I eventually got there in the end just before there was a knock on the door. I can tell you now that I might be skeptical of this kind of phenomenon and these sort of investigations, but I still jumped out of my skin when that knock came. After answering the door, I found that it was Emma Patchford, the London team's medium, who had arrived earlier than expected. I introduced myself and we had a brief chat. She said that she knew the area fairly well where the house was, as she had spent some time there as a child with her family, although she had never heard of Martin or his family before. As all the equipment was off at that moment, it was the perfect opportunity for me to give Emma a quick tour of the house so that she could get the feel of the place or whatever spiritualist mediums do in these situations. Emma admitted to having strong feelings of melancholy in the living room and in Martin's playroom, although I was cautious. I didn't want to let her tell me anything alone without everyone being present, so I asked if she could hold on to her thoughts and feelings and everything else until we were all present, to which she agreed and understood. She took a look at the closet in Martin's playroom, through no enticement from me, of course, as well as a number of other closets and cupboards throughout the house. Eventually, we were back at the front door. I closed it behind me and Emma asked if she could also survey the grounds in as much as the same way as the interior. Absolutely, I said, although I did ask if she needed me to take her as I was keen to get back to the garage and restart all the equipment with Grace, as the house was now empty. Emma was more than happy to walk around at her own pace and I headed back into the garage. By now, it was 6:37 p.m. and myself and Grace had just restarted all the equipment when Tom, Ben, Mark, Martin and Emma came in. "Look who we found on our way," Tom jokingly said in reference to Emma. Emma and Martin were already feverishly talking away, and Martin seemed to take in and take on board everything that was being told to him by Emma. I was listening fairly closely in an attempt to ensure that Martin didn't give anything away that might guide Emma into telling him what he wanted to hear or thought he may have heard. Mark from my team was also writing notes while watching the two's interaction, observing any sign of cold reading and mentalist cheap tricks and untoward influence on Martin. Emma did conduct a séance in the house that night with myself, Martin, Grace and Tom, but the details of that we are keeping for another Dead Soul Social Club extra episode, and details of that you can find at the end of this episode and how to listen. I want to jump now right back to 2:20 a.m. on the second night, where me, Grace and Martin had just placed Martin's rainbow sweater back into his playroom closet. The rainbow sweater story seemed crazy to my team and I when Martin first told us. We all knew straight away when he told us that he still had the sweater that he simply had to bring the sweater with him when we investigated the house. Martin had told Emma earlier in the evening, prior to the seance that we conducted, that he had it, and Emma referred to it as Martin's spiritual trigger object. Those listening may know what this means and understands its relevance. Additionally, it also played a significant part in the seance that we undertook, if you choose to listen to that episode later. Emma too felt that placing the sweater back in his playroom closet would be spiritually significant. While we were in the house, I took my UV light with me to seize the opportunity to see if any of the luminescent pigment powder had been disturbed. In addition, it also allowed me to occupy my mind in the dark house, as I don't mind admitting I was a little bit unnerved whilst being in there at that time and in that level of darkness. Once the sweater was back in the closet, we closed the door and slowly returned to the garage, carefully ensuring that we didn't disturb any of the pigment powder on our way. Back in the garage, I felt good to have some light and a quick cuddle with the dog while Emma explained to the group the significance of the rainbow sweater being placed in that closet. Some in the group were still a little shaken up from the seance that we conducted around 2 hours before, but this only ensured that Emma had their full attention and focus. Emma whispered, "A spiritual trigger object is something that is known to be connected to someone or something from the other realm. In this instance, we know that Martin's sweater was taken and kept for a long time, and it was likely taken by the same entity that pursued Martin for many years through his childhood." All I could think of was the little old lady from the movie Poltergeist at this point. Emma continued, "Martin, it wanted your attention, but never did you any harm. It doesn't want to be here, but it still is. Your sweater in that closet is the sign of an old friend returning, and it will seize the opportunity to feel nostalgia. You are the bridge to life for it." Martin interjected at this point and asked, "What does it want with me though? Does it want to still be alive? Or does it want to come back to life in some way, using me as the conduit?" For me, I was struggling to digest this as it seemed so outlandish to me. It seemed like a bad Hollywood script and there was no science in what Emma was telling Martin. But out of politeness, I held back on my thoughts at this point, thinking that this amount of certain narrative that Emma was pouring would only result in her being caught out at a later point in the evening by one of the team members. Emma answered Martin, "No, it doesn't want to come back to life or use you in some nefarious way. More often than not, a spirit of a passed away loved one is merely trying to execute a final task before passing over, or maybe trying to deliver a message that needs telling." "So, you said loved one, then it's a family member of mine?" Martin asked. "Not necessarily. All spirits are loved ones. They are loved and missed by someone." I just couldn't digest this. Emma was effectively giving the old ghosts are dead people with unfinished business story, and for me that was just too perfect, too romantic, and too schmaltzy to accept. Whilst Emma had produced some shockingly accurate information and details we felt there was no way she could have possibly known earlier in the evening, as well as some strange occurrences that happened around the seance, I felt things were now running away a little bit, and I was concerned that we were now descending into farce, potentially. The night continued from a data standpoint, much like the first night had gone, although in the garage there was a lot more chatter and discussion. I wish I could tell you at a certain time the equipment was triggered, or the readings from the various meters we had throughout the house recorded strange anomalies in the readings, but in all actuality, it didn't. I will reveal now that our equipment recorded no unexplained phenomenon for the entire investigation across both nights. Additionally, the data that we recorded throughout the full 2-day investigation always fed back what it should have, and it never gave us even the slightest reason to view it as anything other than the expected readings and normal, boringly average level outcomes. We simply had no evidence that the house was haunted, that there was any ghostly phenomenon at large within the residence, or anything else paranormal related about it. But, and I will remember this until the day that I die. You may choose to disbelieve this next part as there is no way I can prove it, but I assure you that I am detailing events as they happened that night in March of 2020. Over the 11 months that have passed since this happened, it has been through my mind over and over. I have questioned my own perception and questioned what I saw and heard. I have spoke with a number of trusted friends and discussed these events at great length, and I have even filed a detailed report with a well-known paranormal research institute who have even conducted further research themselves independently. All of that aside, it has made me question my original perception of what I considered the phenomenon of ghosts to actually be and encouraged me to conduct further research. This research is ongoing and will continue ad infinitum. Please, if you don't consider yourself an open-minded individual, I encourage you to stop listening here and potentially listen to our DSSC extra episode regarding the seance, as you may take more from that than you will the end into this. However, those of you who choose to stick with me, thank you, and here we go. By around 6:30 a.m. on that second night, or third morning even, I guess you could call it, most of the team had quieted down. I think everyone was tired but aware they couldn't completely switch off as they had to monitor the equipment and each other. We were all gathered in numerous layers and sleeping bags, coats, woolly jumpers and hats, ensuring we keep warm in that unheated garage. Norman the dog was quietly sleeping away when I looked over, and I remember thinking how jealous I was of the little guy, wishing I was at home in bed curled up fast asleep. Martin and Emma were still chatting about the phenomenon. Also, this was now at a point where Martin was asking questions to which Emma would answer, and Martin would take a few minutes to digest what he was told. Martin said to Emma, "What if my rainbow sweater is gone again when we check in the morning?" "Well, we have the entire house locked down and every inch surveilled, so if it's gone, it provides us with exceptional evidence, don't you think? Plus also, the kitchen door is right outside the garage door. So even if, for some random reason, a person tried entering the playroom, we'd hear them breaking into the room," Emma came back. "Unless they broke in the front door," Martin said. "I just mean, if someone was playing a practical joke on us or messing around, they'd break straight into the playroom. Kitchen door is right there. The front door is on the other side of the house and would set the equipment off." I picked up on this conversation. It didn't make any sense to me. I could see Martin looking confused too, so I joined in. "But neither the kitchen door or the front door are anywhere near the playroom. Entering through either would be picked up by our sensors," I said. Emma, thinking and looking questioned, "But the playroom is next to the kitchen, isn't it?" "No," I said. "It's at the top of the stairs at the back of the house. It's above the utility room, which is the room you were mistaking it for, I believe. Remember when I showed you around and you said that you felt feelings of melancholy in there?" Emma looked quietly and confused and asked me outright, "When did you show me around the house?" Others in the team were listening into our conversation now and taking more notice. "When you first arrived yesterday, you said you were here early and I was in the house fixing a light. It was just before the others came back from going on a food run, after which you walked around the exterior of the house, remember?" I said. At this point, I could feel a cold sweat coming over me, and the hairs on my arms, neck, and back standing on end. I felt like something was watching me. I felt a creepy fear. I hadn't felt this before. Mark from my team told me that they had picked Emma up from the station when they went to get food, and that she came back with them, following which they all came straight into the garage to greet Grace and I. I was adamant that Emma had come to the door and I had given her a tour of the house, which lasted well over 30 minutes. We spoke loads during the tour, and I got on really well with her. But Emma was equally as certain that she got off the train and was met by Mark, Tom, Ben and Martin, and that she drove back to the house with them and came straight into the garage, which was the first time that she had met me. She also firmly said that she had never had a tour of the house from me or anyone else. Neither did she walk around the grounds. She stated that since she arrived, she was always in a group of three or more people. She'd never been alone or in a group of two people. I was horrified and completely baffled. It can't have been anyone else. It was her. I could pick her out of a crowd. Her hair, her face, her clothes. It was exactly how she looked now. It was definitely her. "Do you have a twin?" I grasped. Emma partially laughed and said no. had Mark from my own team, someone I have known for over 10 years and who I find to be incredibly trustworthy, not been with the group when they picked Emma up from the station, then I would have suspected that it was a ploy by the other team to fool me or bend the investigation in the direction that they wanted. But Mark was with them, and he too was certain that Emma came out of the station and got in the car and came back to the house with them. A station that was several miles away, so Emma physically could not have been at both places. Grace, again someone I have known for many years and whom I trust dearly, said, "Jamie, when she got here, she even said to me, 'I can't wait to see inside the house, it looks lovely.' Why would she say that if she'd already had a tour?" I accepted what I was being told. I simply racked my brain trying to picture in my mind if there was anything strange or different about the Emma that I had shown around the house. "Emma," I asked, "have you ever been to this area before, either recently or as a child perhaps?" "No," she said. "I'm from Nottingham originally, before I moved to London. This is the furthest south I have ever been today. Why?"
"Just wondering," I replied.
I'm going to end things there for tonight, everyone. 11 months on, I am still as confused as I was back in March of 2020. Many close friends have offered theories and explanations. None are totally fit or I want to accept without science to support it, though. What do you think happened that night? I offer this out to you guys. Who did I encounter? What are your thoughts on the events? Please message me, DM me, email me, either via our website or our Instagram or our Facebook group, which you can access through our website, which is www.deadsoulsocialclub.com. I also read all messages, DMs and comments on our Instagram, so I suggest you go there and contact me via that. I would love to hear what you all think. I would love to hear your theories. So finally, I mentioned earlier in this episode that we have recorded a DSSC extra episode. This talks all about the seance and the Ouija board experiment that we conducted at the house and features a lot more of Emma the medium and her spiritualist theories. We felt the need to release this as its own episode, as the occurrences and details therein don't necessarily fit into the scientific narrative that we try to uphold on our show. Although, I will say, it is a belter of a special extra episode. It's around 60 minutes of spooky spiritualist theories and a creepy-ass seance, so what's not to love? If you want access to this special seance episode, it will cost the princely sum of just £2, so it's less than the cost of a cup of coffee. Details of how to order the special episode will be posted on our website, Instagram and Facebook group at midnight tonight. Thanks everyone, stay safe and happy Valentine's Day. Sleep tight and remember, stand firm as you enter the darkest night.